Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Welcome in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got a very good show in store today, folks. Here's the deal. Sometimes we talk about I don't even know what the name of the word is. I'll have to ask our guest. Iconography? Is that what the word is? I think it is. It's, you know what it is. It's taking an image and we take it as one thing, but it's another, right? You take the, well, here, I'll hold it up for you on video, right? I'm drinking one of these. I probably shouldn't with diabetes, but my sugars have been really good. I'm talking about Coca-Cola. You think about Coca-Cola, and we talk about one of the images that they actually brought to the forefront, Santa Claus. We're coming up on Christmas, right? So you think about Santa Claus, and you think, well, Santa Claus, that's not a Coca-Cola image, is it? It turns out it is. The red and white suit of Santa Claus was brought to us by Coca-Cola. See, red and white, Santa Claus. There's another image that we're going to talk about today, and the fact that it has another meaning than what we know it to mean. Now, when I bring up the word Baphomet or the name Baphomet, automatically I know you're thinking evil, and I know I'm going to get a lot of kickback from some people in my audience today when I say we're going to talk about Baphomet today. It's okay, kids. Don't get all weird on me when I say we're going to talk about Baphomet today. I swear to you, it's going to be okay. The fact of the matter is when it comes to Baphomet, there's more than one meaning when it comes to Baphomet. Now, I've told you before in the past that I have Templar ties or Templar roots in my own history, in my own background. As it turns out, it was my 18th great-grandfather, so it would be Bernard de Tromley, who was the fourth Grandmaster of the Knights Templar. And he was beheaded at Ascalon in 1153. So now I'm reading our guest's book and paging through to see if where he falls in this book. And actually, I was riveted to this book, which the name of this book that we're going to talk about today is Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. Our guest today is Dr. Heather Lynn, which I'm glad to have her back on the program today. I'm absolutely ecstatic to have her back on the program today. And the common conception, misconception, we'll talk to Dr. Lynn today about it, is that the Templar worshipped Baphomet. We'll get into that as well today. But what was Baphomet? Was Baphomet the devil? Was Baphomet a symbol of, well, of different religions, or was Baphomet a symbol of something else? I know what Baphomet symbolizes today and which religion has co-opted it to make it its own. And you in the audience think Baphomet is evil. We'll explain why Baphomet isn't necessarily evil. I know you may be saying, well, Tim, you've been corrupted now by the devil because you think Baphomet isn't evil. that isn't necessarily so. We'll explain why when we bring in our guest today, Dr. Heather Lynn. Dr. Heather Lynn is a historian of the human mind, xenoarchaeologist, adjunct professor of humanities, and author of The Anunnaki Connection and Evil Archaeology. I know I said I wasn't going to talk evil, and then I said she's the the author of Evil Archaeology. Heather holds degrees in archaeology, information technology, and history, as well as a doctorate in education from the University of New England. Her academic work concentrates on cognitive archaeology, consciousness, artificial intelligence, symbolism, iconography, I believe I said it right that time, and the exploration of myth and art through a Jungian conceptual framework. Heather hosts the Midnight Academy podcast on YouTube and all major podcasting platforms. When she's not teaching, writing, or otherwise exploring the mysteries of the mind, space, and time, she plays the French horn in a local symphony orchestra whose performances raise money to provide art and cultural education to low-income communities. She has recently taken up the violin. Heather is also a practitioner of Krav Maga, a military self-defense system, and finds tranquility in classical and liturgical music, meditation, hiking, tennis, flower gardening, and a good cup of tea. There's something we have in common as well. Let's welcome back in to Darkness Radio, Dr. Heather Lynn. Hi, Dr. Lynn. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Is it iconography?
Yes, it is.
All right. Yeah. I knew eventually I'd get my tongue twisted back the right way and I'd be able to say it, but iconography. Yep. Sometimes iconography. I can't get the right emphasis on the wrong syllable, so... I don't know.
Yeah. It's often they say mispronunciation like that is a sign that you are very well read, that you learned those things from reading as opposed to hearing them in the traditional lecture form. So there's that.
I'm about to mess up the name of the man who actually drew the symbol of Baphomet for the very first time, too, because my French is horrible.
Yeah, mine too. I mean, so I'll mess it up with you. I wrote about it and I can't.
Right?
It's not good.
I'm French and I can't pronounce it. I mean, even though I had French and I
did too, yeah.
Yeah, but I can't, I don't know.
I can read it and I say that I can't speak it because it's just an embarrassment to hear me try.
Right.
And, you know, they're very particular about how you get that language correct. So,
No. Yeah, my relatives founded Quebec, but I can't tell you anything about French. So I don't know. I'm a horrible Frenchman.
Yes. Well,
yeah. So
you win some, you lose some.
I do know this though. Have you seen St. Denis Medical on NBC?
No.
I do know it's not St. Denis. It's St. Denis because that was my original name over the border.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. It wasn't St. It wasn't Denis. It was St. Denis. So.
Yep. St. Denis.
Yeah. And St. Denis was the one who had his head beheaded and then spoke the gospel afterwards after being beheaded. So there you go.
Wow, that would be quite a thing to see.
I know. We've always been good puppeteers, so there you go.
Or would that be marionettes?
It would be a marionette, wouldn't it? It would be
en français.
See, there you go. I've already failed in my French, and you've excelled. So there you go.
I took a lot of French. I took French all through college as well, and I thankfully can read, but again, will not speak it. I will not speak it. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It sounds so ridiculous when I try.
I don't even do the French version of croissant. I just say croissant.
No, croissant.
Yeah, croissant.
Croissant.
It seems so weird.
That's okay. We're American. We can say it however we want.
That's right.
It's prosciutto.
That's right.
Croissant.
That's right. We fought wars.
We don't have any of this FX.
That's right. We fought wars, so we don't have to say FX, right? Or affect, one or the other.
Yeah.
Baphomet.
Ah.
Yeah. A controversial symbol that a lot of people would say, well, Tim, why are you talking about that symbol? It's evil. Why are you talking about evil? Are you trying to bring down the devil on you, on us? What are you doing, Tim? Why are you talking about evil on your show? Are we truly talking about evil here, Heather? Is this thing truly an evil symbol? Was evil the intent? Is it Levi or Levi, or how do you pronounce the man's name who first came up with the symbol?
Levi.
Levi?
Levi.
It was
It would be the emphasis. If you're actually wanting the French way, the accent aigu is on the E in the biggest, so the accent would be Levy.
It'd be
but we'll just call him Levy. Okay. Because we're American.
That's right, because we're American, damn it.
Levy.
Levy.
Eliphas Levy.
Although Levy. The San Francisco 49ers say it's Levi Stadium, so I don't know.
Hey. Yeah. So we'll call him Levy. Levy. But it's Levy.
Okay.
But yes, that is I'll give a whole spoiler to the book then right now. Levy was a French Catholic priest, and he drew the picture of Baphomet that we so readily recognize as the scary goat-headed androgynous figure sitting with a caduceus in his lap and a pentagram on the head, the torch between the horns and all of that. The image, the first and arguably only image of Baphomet that has come into our zeitgeist comes from him. And he was doing this as not actually a rebellion per se, but an effort to make an icon of what he called the true Catholicism. He looked at this as a figure that would represent love and unity and God's love in particular. So much so that the images we may associate with evil, like the Goat of Mendes or that, in the end would achieve wisdom and unity under God's love. And so, long story short, spoiler to the book, Baphomet is a symbol of true Christianity and love and unity. Oh. So how do we get now? So, okay. So I guess that's the end of the book, right? No, because clearly there's a lot more to unpack there. Why is this ugly creature supposed to like represent some sort of love, and how come it doesn't really now, and why did it happen to begin with? Why would this image, what is the name Baphomet? There's so much there. And so the reason I wrote the book was an effort to, as I say, not have an apology, not a promotion, but also not anti-Baphomet. There was no side necessarily. It's just an inquisitive look at the history, and perhaps more so the historiography of the symbol itself. What is this thing? Why are we seeing a lot more of it these days? Why do celebrities sort of promote it? What is this symbol of rebellion? What is this all about? And it's clearly a scary looking drawing. So, you know, it had me curious about the nature of evil. And then people, as of course I wrote the book Evil Archaeology, to sort of look into this as well. Like, is there such a thing as evil or demons? And what is it with a person that they bring to this question? Is it something that is just a reflection of their own sort of good versus bad? Is it they're looking at it through that lens? Or what is this here? So it was more of a question of like, what do we have that's going on? And a lot of the answers were surprising, at least for me.
So now that we've established that originally it was good, I want to fast way forward to the current day. All right.
Sort of good. At least maybe initial intention was good.
Right.
A lot more to unpack there with his view of what true Catholicism was.
Right. And we're going to leave a lot of it for the book. We're going to leave a lot of it for people to look through in the book, because the book is absolutely fascinating. There's so much there, folks. And I am going to leave a lot of it for you to read, because there's not only history in here of the actual symbol itself, there's history of the Templar, which is absolutely fascinating. We may skim over parts of it today. There's history of the Rosicrucians there. There's history of the Freemasons there. There's history of how people have taken the symbol of Baphomet and maybe twisted it to the... Is it fair to say, Heather, twisted it to their means of how they want to see it? Not necessarily worship it, but to see it.
I would say that's fair. I would say that it really has to do with your view of this, maybe what you might call a spiritual battle that we found ourselves in for the past 500 plus years. It really depends on what you're bringing to it in your worldview. So, but yeah, I would say that it has been twisted. But again, that's not to suggest that it is a very good sign and people have just used it against, you know, the regular people and all of that. But there is some of that there. So it's a little more complex because there's many different people doing different things with the symbol. So in some cases, yes, it's been twisted, but in other cases, maybe misunderstood is a better way to frame it.
So in order to understand how corrupted Baphomet has become, I want to come all the way forward, and then I'm going to go back again. Okay, I'm going to take people on a weird journey. You take people linearly from beginning to end, but I'm going to skip for our purposes here today. I want to bring people all the way to current day, because current day, boy, is it a symbol that gets people going, and especially right now in the music industry. It seems like right now, music industry, fashion industry, it's one of those things where if you see that symbol, and it's more the five-pointed pentagram with Baphomet's head or the goat head in the middle of it that's being shown. Not necessarily, and I suppose the entire image of Baphomet, but when you see that, boy, people jump. I mean, it is something that you just go, whoa, that's the image that puts you over.
Yeah.
And I think now it's more, is it safe to say it's more put in line with, I don't want to say Illuminati or it's put in line with people who are lined up with secret societies, or it's put more in line with people who are up to nefarious, no good things behind closed doors? Is that pretty much what it's put in line with now?
I would say so. Yeah. If you just would do a Google search for Baphomet, you're going to see images like Jay-Z and Beyonce. You're going to see references to Epstein and Diddy parties and Hollywood elites. And you're even going to see news stories from a couple of years back. It was a really big thing. People were protesting, in particular, parents were protesting Target for having a line of clothing geared towards children with cute little Baphomets on the shirts. They had little buttons that would say Baphomet loves you and all of this. And they were cute in the sense that it was clearly Baphomet, but it had this like Sanrio Hello Kitty kind of artistic quality to it that was clearly marketed to children. So people had a problem with that, even though it wasn't even a scary image at that point. It was just a cute little goat saying Baphomet loves you. So it's been in the news because it represents a lot of things that people have a problem with. And it has been, you know, I don't want to say it's been co-opted, because in a lot of ways, it hasn't necessarily been co-opted. It's been embraced for the symbol that it initially was, at least when Levy illustrated it. So again, it really comes down to, so we'll jump around, like you said. So if you're looking at this contemporary image of it, this thing that sort of makes people very afraid, and a lot of times people refer to it as a deity. And that's something I didn't really find much evidence of, even in Satanism and all of these organized efforts to exalt the figure as some sort of important symbol or icon. It still isn't necessarily seen as a deity per se. So very few people are actually worshiping this as a living deity. And so that's something important to point out. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't people who think that they're doing that or try to do that. It's like when I wrote in Evil Archaeology, the instance of Pazuzu, the guy who changed his name. His name was, I think, John Lawson. Mm-hmm. And he ended up changing his name to Pazuzu because he wanted to worship Pazuzu and do all of these things. And he ended up murdering and cannibalizing his neighbors, a big case in North Carolina some years ago. So he was worshiping Pazuzu, the Anunnaki, essentially demon, a demon from Mesopotamia, this sort of figure. But that doesn't mean that Pazuzu worship is actually a thing. It's some people will do these things, but it's not a condoned or organized way of worshiping per se. So not historically, at least. Baphomet, I would put in the same category. Historically, it's not something worshiped aside from the accusations of the Templar, which is a whole nother thing in and of itself. But in the contemporary context, there is not an emphasis in worshiping the deity Baphomet. So that's something that people usually misunderstand, because it does get put in our face as some sort of important image that harkens to demonology and scary things. It's no way to dance around it. It's just a scary image. It's scary because it has all of these archetypal significant symbols associated with it, like the goat and things that resonate with us who are in an Abrahamic framework, people who would be whether or not you're practicing a religious person, somebody who would be Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, if you have been brought up in that ethos, in that culture, a lot of these symbols are going to resonate with you as something that is counter to your belief set. And so you're already programmed to look at these archetypal images and kind of say, ooh, I don't like that. And even at a baser level, just the fact that it's a chimera or a mixed image of a human with an animal head also makes us sort of pause. That's a very old, an old image that you'll find in cave walls, anything where there's this sort of hybridized animal beast motif. And it has been used for a long time to create a sense of fear, or sometimes empowerment, but at least to somehow stir people up on a subconscious level. There's something inherently off-putting or intriguing or titillating even to see the image of a human being mixed with the image of an animal. So it creates a sense of unease at the most baseline archetypal level. So then you have this figure Baphomet, who is being used to promote all kinds of different ideologies and troll people in those Abrahamic contexts. So it leaves the question, well, why? You know, how did we get that image to, you know, like how did a French priest who was using this as a symbol of God's love and enlightenment, how did that become something so frightening? And that really has to do with the fact that at the time, this individual priest, who is well-meaning for the most part, he was a very devout man, and he really believed in the mysticism and the magic and the beauty of the Catholic faith. However, he noticed that the church didn't seem to live up to those standards and values, and he felt that there was a lot of hypocrisy, and he felt very motivated by some of the political movements that he saw around him in that time. So this was the 1800s, early in mid-1800s, like 1830. He was very, very interested in one of the newer movements, socialism. So he looked at socialism as this way to understand Catholicism. So the idea of being Catholic, it meant like a unity. The word itself means together, unity. So he looked at this like, okay, the universal sort of unifying component of love and the brotherhood of all men is best represented in this socialist utopia, not in the Catholic Church. So he decides that this fusing of Christian mysticism and socialism was the, quote, true Catholicism. And so that's where we get the symbol of Baphomet coming out as a rebellion. And so that's a key thing there. It's a rebellion against not necessarily Christianity, even though it would look to be the case, but it's a rebellion against the orthodoxy. It's a rebellion against the whole patriarchal system. He was very interested in feminism. He was very interested in all of these new social causes. And so he looked at this new way of thinking of mysticism and Christianity as the right way. And so that's what he used Baphomet to be a symbol of, was this rebellious, but not anti-Christ. And so that's where it gets a little different, because you would look at it and say, well, it's anti-Christian. But in his view, it was anti-organized, patriarchal, you know, establishment, this, that, and the other. And it was a reversion to the true Catholicism, the true Christianity, where women would be included and all sorts of people would have this beautiful utopia under the banner of unity, and there'd be no opposition anymore. It would be the left and the right fusing into one and just happiness and, again, utopia.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, you can look at it there and say, well, was this a good thing or was this a bad thing? And that's going to really depend on your view of things like socialism or mm-hmm. things like utopia or concepts of many different things. So essentially, if you want to judge the content of his character, you could say he was doing what he thought was right. If you are coming at it from a perspective of, you know, I don't believe in that. I don't think the unity of opposites is where, you know, we find Christ or whatever, then that's what we'll have. So he ended up rejecting the church and its sort of authority altogether, taking on a mystical name, Eliphas Levi, and writing about magic. And he became an occult practitioner and a magician, and was highly regarded as one of the most important magicians of the modern era. And in it. He talked about the unity of opposites. It was very heavily involved with secret societies and those types of teachings, sort of like alchemy, ideas of magnetism, any of those esoteric and occult studies. So Baphomet, given that Baphomet itself represented an escape from all of these heterodox sort of patriarchal systems and capitalistic systems and all of this, you see it die down once Levy is sort of out of the picture, but you see a resurgence of it in the 1960s with the second occult revival. And then you start seeing similar things happen where young people start to get influenced by ideas of socialist utopia and rebellion. And so they take on what maybe you could call Luciferian ideas. So it's not necessarily demonic, but you could call it Luciferian insofar as it's about enlightenment and positivity and, you know, rationality and all of this. But of course, Luciferian to others would be negative. It's satanic. It's bad because it's anti the church. So this is where you get the tension. So it becomes a symbol again in the 1960s. And it is used to promote these ideas that the younger people were having at that time. And it's been politicized since. And then it kind of goes away and then it comes back again with people who think of themselves as cultural creatives, as they sometimes are referred to as, people who are looking for better ways, but they do so through rebellion, revolution, and that sort of thing. So essentially, Baphomet is a symbol of revolution. It's a symbol of modernism and postmodernism in particular, with the merging of opposites and to where there is no opposition anymore. It's just order out of chaos. And it's a very strong symbol. Again, some of these things, it's like arguing about the Enlightenment. To be enlightened, I would say, is a pretty good thing. It's a great to be post-Enlightenment.
Sure.
But at the same time, there's a level of enlightenment, so to speak, that could be deemed Illuminati or Luciferian. So it's really a more nuanced topic than that. And it's easy to throw Baphomet out with just another scary demonic figure without understanding the complexity of the symbol.
I tell you what, I have an interesting theory as to where the extension of Baphomet comes from, and the duality of Baphomet may come from as well. But we'll take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the male-female dynamic of Baphomet and what it may actually be an extension of as well, and also where the Templar tie comes in. As well, I want to talk about the Templar tie to Baphomet as well in this program. There's something you hit on the book, which hits home with some other theories. You hit on a lot of things in the book, which is actually a little scary. I want to talk to you off air about this as well, because there's some interesting theories in this book that I think people really ought to read and read into. Again, there's way too much for us to get into in this program, but I really encourage people to read this book, as there's so much information in this book that not only get it, if you're a Templar history buff, I think you should read into this book or read this book. Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon, not only gets into the history of Baphomet from its early origins to now, but also follows Templars, Gnostics, Rosicrucians, Freemasons, and follows that whole line and gives you an idea of the duality of Baphomet. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about Levy and a theory I have, and I want to bounce it off you and see what you think. So we'll do that when we come back. Dr. Heather Lynn is our guest. The book is Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. Does that sacred icon reveal the founders of Catholicism? And I'll let you know what I mean by that, and maybe someone that the Templars truly worshipped. I'll get into that when I come back, right here on the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
a Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff. Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. My guest is Dr. Heather Lynn. The name of the book, Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. Now, before the break, I teased that maybe Levy had taken and created Baphomet out of the two, the male and the female. I want to say influences that started the Catholic Church. You may say male and female influences that started the Catholic Church. What would the male and female influences that be that started the Catholic Church? And it would also be, and I tease that it would be who the Knights Templar truly worshipped. There's been the rumor for quite some time that the Knights Templar truly worshipped Mary Magdalene. And it's been surmised in recent years that Mary Magdalene was actually an apostle and that there are lost scriptures that are out there from Mary Magdalene that are either known to exist or think are exist or may have been gotten rid of altogether. And that there's even a church in a cave in France where she had her own ministry. Now I would ask you this, Heather: could it be that Baphomet was inspired? The duality of Baphomet was inspired by the pairing of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. That this was Levy's voice saying, no, the church, the Catholic Church, really is supposed to be formed around the pairing of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They truly were husband and wife. They truly were bonded, and that the church truly is formed from a union of man and wife.
Wow. I think that you are very close. I mean, I think that's fair to say. There's a lot of discussion about what the Templars were actually worshiping or who the Templars were accused of worshiping. And it's definitely tied to Baphomet. If you look at the original explanation, there's the traditional explanation of the etymology of the word Baphomet being linked to Muhammad. So the idea initially was that due to their time in the Middle East, they had assimilated and been involved with different sects, in, most notably the Assassins, and started taking on sort of what we would think of now as Sufi religious belief sets, more mystic Islamic practices, and that they were caught in the act of worshiping Muhammad. And in sort of like the French language or pronunciation at the time, it would have been misinterpreted as a Mahomet, but it meant Muhammad. And so that's sort of the initial idea that people claim is the right idea. But if you look at the Templar, there's a couple other two. I mean, that's just the one that is probably the most predominant. There are different ways of looking at that in terms of numerology and a lot of different explanations for the word itself, Baphomet. But what you see in the Templar trials, with which the transcripts are available even online, you can look at them word for word. A lot of people are surprised about that, but they did keep good records, and you can read the transcripts of the trial, and you can see they were accused of worshiping Baphomet. And how Baphomet is described, it varies. It varies from accounts of it being a severed human head, a bearded man. It also could be a cat. And so a lot of variation there over what it was that they were actually worshiping. Now, the problem too, if you consider the origin of these testimonies, they were under duress, they were being tortured. And so some of them confessed all sorts of things that we don't really have a way of validating as true or not. So it leaves more to the mystery. But there is the school of thought that is that Baphomet was a Gnostic sort of expression, that it was this view of what we might call the alchemical marriage, or a view of the worship of the divine feminine and the embodiment of Sophia as wisdom, which has a lot of connection to Mary Magdalene and the idea of the divine feminine force in unity with the divine masculine. And so this idea of combining the masculine and the feminine in this divine unity, I would say, could very well be associated with those old tales of the Templars' belief that Mary Magdalene was the wife of Jesus. And of course, what does that mean? That means that there is a line, a bloodline still that they've had to protect since. And of course, we go down the Holy Blood, Holy Grail mystery and all of the things that entails. And was Levy familiar with this? I would say so. I mean, he was located in France. He had access to a lot of different documents, and he a part of the big problem he had with the church, aside from just the general bureaucracy of it, was he felt that it was missing this mysticism. He was very learned. He was an educator himself, and he understood that there were these other mystical aspects to the church that the actual dogmatic structure of the Catholic Church at the time, they were not interested in exploring at all. Mm-hmm. So I think it could be very fair to say that he understood and came across a lot of the information about the marriage, the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and that this was his effort to depict that in a symbol, an icon, that he viewed could be meditated on. Now, it's a little clearly, again, you're looking at this ugly beast and this thing that we now consider to be a demon and say, wow, okay, but he could have done a better job making it more beautiful, right? But I think maybe I'll go out on a limb here. I already get hate mail. So
sure.
I'll go out on a limb and say this. Perhaps it was genius of him to do it that way, because if you look at Baphomet and you have that sort of cultural baggage, you have the innate understanding of the archetypes and symbolism, and you look at that image, initially you're going to have some sense of unease. You're going to be taken aback and say, ooh, I don't know that I like that. He would ask that you press on and that you face your fear, and that is really the fear of this that is holding you back, and that God doesn't have fear. Faith is the antidote to fear. And so he is asking people to look upon this image and not have fear, but instead have faith and accept that God's love transcends even the ugliest or most frightening of beings. And that if we have faith in the true loving nature of God, that all things will be unified in that presence. And for us to have a more forgiving and accepting viewpoint of things, even so far as to look at something as awful as the goat of Mendes and say, you know, the thing was, it was placed at the top. There's a couple different aspects of that symbol that's important. That pentagram that's on his head, it's not upside down.
Right.
And some people could say, well, that's not here nor there, but it is. It's very important because the upward facing star like that, the pentagram, it is a pro-human image. It is the symbol of man in an upward facing position with his head towards God. And so it is a symbol of uniting with God in wisdom. If it was upside down, it would be anti-human. Mm-hmm. And it would be something where you're acknowledging the base sort of drives of human nature and things that would be considered more evil. So it's a lot of this nuance within this symbol that if you start to pick it apart bit by bit, you see that it's actually trying to say ascend through enlightenment, through wisdom, through Sophia, come together and have this sort of holy marriage, this alchemical marriage of unity. And you too will, I guess, ascend in the way Christ did. Now, again, that could be problematic for people because some people don't like that level of hubris. They don't want to say we can become like gods in that Nietzschean sense. So Nietzsche had that viewpoint that, you know, God is dead and we have killed him. And so eventually we would have to become like gods. So that gets into the questions of transhumanism and our actual ability to transcend. So there's another issue with that. Are we looking at an enlightenment as some sort of grand scheme that we can achieve, or does it border on pathology that would allow us to fall victim to systems of oppression and problems like we're chasing a utopia that would never exist? Those are some common arguments you would have with socialism, mm-hmm. or the idea that eventually it becomes communism and that there is no such thing as a utopia, and so we need to have more hubris, etc. But that was the worldview that he was adopting, is that there could be this utopia, there could be heaven on earth, and that through this mystical marriage of the divine feminine and masculine, we could become like gods in a way. We could become Christ-like. So I think that is a fair assessment. And again, that's, you can see right there that there could be a problem with that. You could embrace that thinking and say, wow, that is very inspirational. Maybe Baphomet's not so bad after all. Or you could say, hey, you know, we need to have more hubris than that. We shouldn't be building towers of Babylon, you know, the Tower of Babel in Babylon, because look, it fell apart and we need to know our place and worship God and fear God, et cetera. And so that's why it becomes this divisive and interesting figure that leaves people to this day either saying, oh no, I don't want any part of that. I don't want to buy the book. I've had that told to me. Is the cover's too scary? I can't even look at it. All the way to people saying, oh, let's put a cute little Baphomet on a four-year-old sweatshirt, like, and everything in between. So it is a quite a heavy, nuanced figure that I think deserves a well-reasoned analysis, and not to be afraid. To not fear something doesn't mean that you embrace it and love it and call it your own. It just is an empowering thing to have that understanding to say, you know, if you are against Baphomet per se, at least know why. Right. You could legitimately say, hey, you know, I'm not for that sort of utopian thinking. I'm not thinking that we need to dissolve all things in order to pull out some sort of unified order. That's great. But if you are for Baphomet, you need to be able to explain why too. So there just needs to be like a full understanding of that image in order for you to take a side if you so choose to do.
It seems like it's more of a symbol to shock you, to get you to think, and then to rally you as to whether you want to get on board or not. It's not.
It seems like that.
It's not a cute, cuddly mascot by any means.
No. Not at all.
No, not at all. No, not at all.
Not at all.
I want to bring it around to the Templar, because you spend a good amount of time on the Templar in your book, and it's quite interesting. You know, you bring up the Sufis, and it got me to thinking about, I don't know if the term is alternate history. But in the bit of alternate history that I've studied, having Templar for family, I find it fascinating. It's very fascinating indeed. One of the things that has been pointed out to me, and this is the only thing I could add to what you've come up with in the book. I was always told that with Templar, well, first of all, you're always told when you have Templar as family that everything is BS that was put out there in the first place as far as the narrative of Templar, but that's neither here nor there. But of course you're going to believe that as family, right? But the one thing that is told is that when the Templar supposedly crossed over into, and this is again alternate history, if you believe that they crossed over to North America and had dealings with the indigenous people, that they taught the indigenous people certain, and if you believe they came through North America, and some people believe that even they came through Minnesota, like if you believe in the rune stone, if you believe any of the deal with the rune stone, and that has Templar origins and not necessarily Norwegian origins, and that the rune stone is actually a land claim, such as certain friends of ours say, then you would believe that that the Templar, when they ran into the indigenous people, warned the indigenous people that there are invaders coming from across the Atlantic. In other words, you know, the king is sending people to occupy this land. When they come, you're going to need a certain set of skills. Now, we come in peace. So we're not here to invade you. We're here to trade certain things. Whether you believe this or not is not for me to tell you, okay? But one of the interesting things that you put in the book that make me think that this was the way of the Templar. The reason I believe, and this is just me, one of the reasons I believe the Templar were burned at the stake is not that the Templar, as they were accused of, worshiping Muhammad. I don't believe they worshiped Muhammad, but I believe they traded customs with the Muslims. In other words, they traded, much like if they ran into the indigenous people here in America, they would trade ways. So they would learn something from the indigenous people. Indigenous people would say, here's corn. This is how, you know, take this back with you. Or here's a certain, you know, here's certain food that you can take back with you. Here's certain ways that you can take back with you and to build. Here's certain tools you can take with you. This is how we do things. And the Templar gives certain things to the indigenous people and say, here's how we do things where we're from. And there's an information exchange. I believe they did this with the Sufis because they found Muslims who were actually sympathetic to their cause. Because when you're that far away from home and you're fighting a war, you need allies. You don't have a supply line. I believe also at that point, with the king and the pope getting ready to cut them off because they owed them too much money, they knew this well ahead of time. They knew that the king and the pope were going to turn on them. They knew they were going to have allies. So at that point, they were building safe routes throughout the world in which they knew they were going to have to escape. They knew France was not going to be safe for them for too much longer. So they knew they were going to have to escape not only out into Europe, but out into the New World. They were going to have to go out into Asia, out into different ways. They knew they were going to have to spread throughout the world because they were eventually going to be hunted by the Catholics. They were going to be hunted by France. They were going to be hunted by maybe even the major powers of Europe. It just depended on the situation. I don't think they knew it was coming that quickly. I think they thought that maybe they could work things out, at least with the King of France, maybe not the Pope, or maybe the Pope. It just depended. But it all ended in 1307. As far as we know, it ended in 1307. I don't think it did. I think there were a certain amount of Templar that gave themselves up so that the rest could live, and then the rest could continue on to modern day. But I do think that there was no worshiping of Muhammad, but I think there was dealings with the Sufis, and I think there were dealings with other friendly Muslim bands to help them live. So when you hear stories of, it'd be like modern trade today. That'd be like saying, it'd be like saying the U.S. worships Mexico, or Mexico worships the U.S. Well, no, we have a trade agreement. They're friends, right? We worship Canada, and Canada worships us. That would be a misunderstanding of our relationship, you know. Well, we're friendly, you know, or we worship England and England worships us. Well, we don't worship each other. We have a friendly trade agreement and we're friends. I think the language got miscued because the king and the Pope needed to come after the Templar. They needed a reason to execute them.
And And
they needed that excuse. I don't know. It's just, I think that's just the way I see it. Everything stinks to high heaven with me when I hear this story. I mean, it really does. Yeah. You know?
That's a very good point. I think that you hit the nail on the head, really. I don't think it was about Muhammad, the individual. I think that was just the way of understanding what they were doing, because if you're persecuting them, that's going to be the low-hanging fruit is, oh, well, they're worshiping Muhammad. Isn't that what the Islamists do? You're not going to know what it is they're actually understanding, and understanding that there are different groups within Islam, especially back then even, that had different ways of worship, like the Sufis. And there were mystics and people who were influencing each other, and it was a great mix. I mean, they were there for quite a while and getting enculturated and sharing a culture and exchanging ideas back and forth. And so you're going to have to imagine some level of religious syncretism went on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that it did. And so the kind of understanding that the Templars had of their own religion, their own Christian religion, is going to be very different than what the people back home, so to speak, believe. And so, but they had all that power. They had the power, they had the money, they had the influence to continue to worship in the way that they saw fit. They didn't have as much oversight until like you mentioned, they were closing in. They were going to the king and the Pope. Just they needed to put an end to this level of power that they had, and so it would be very easy to just say, well, heresy, and that's what they did. So, but to understand that the actual things that the Templars were probably doing, what would that look like? Would it look like our understanding of worshiping Muhammad, so to speak, as today? Not at all. It's going to be very different.
Right.
Just in the context of time and space, that this was a long time ago and they were doing different things. But also when you consider that their interest and their alliances with particular groups that are known kind of aligned more in this shared philosophy that you can see a thread of, that we would now maybe call Gnosticism, different versions of Gnosticism. So it's something that could be shared with people who are of the Jewish faith, people who are, you know, in all those Abrahamic senses, there is this undercurrent. There's this other way of thinking that was Gnostic. And so it, you could imagine a scenario where the Templars, who had an understanding of their own Christian mysticism to an extent, but maybe there were some knowledge gaps there, if they were to interact and share their beliefs with, say, a Gnostic viewpoint in Islam, there's going to be this overlap that they can have this understanding. They're going to be able to fill in gaps, and it can work together because they're essentially pulling from the same mix, the same sort of ocean of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I think that what you're seeing a lot of in that context is the sharing of the more Gnostic and mystic viewpoints of those religions and where they unite. And so Sufism, as we understand it today, but even then, it could have a lot of this Gnostic reverence for, say, Sophia. The Kabbalah, that system of understanding also incorporates Sophia and this idea of the unity of opposites. So we consider the Kabbalah something more akin to a Jewish practice, like Jewish mysticism. Right. But again, it's not necessarily about Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. It's about that mystical undercurrent that is more aptly described as Gnosticism. And so that esoteric, that secretive way of expressing the mystic view of that religion is what made them, well, persona non grata, for one thing, and also united them with the groups within Islam that were also practicing similar things. So it's a shared, I think Huxley was the one who first called it the perennial philosophy. It's the esoteric. It's been around for that long, if not arguably longer. I argue that this esoteric worldview has started not even in Egypt, which a lot of people consider that it was an Egyptian form of belief, but I hold that it goes as far back as Sumer, that this was a system of understanding that was started at the very beginning of civilization when we developed a priest class and we had to have, or felt we had to have, this intermediary between us and a god. And that it developed into this esoteric, exoteric mystery religion way of going about our understanding of the cosmos and mysticism overall. And I think that that tradition has just been one that has been an undercurrent ever since. It's like this golden thread, and people stumble upon it, and it's the occult. It's what's not seen. When they stumble upon it, sometimes they get excited and rally the troops and get it all together, and they start promoting these images again. They look back and say, oh, wait, now I understand. I mean, the Beatles did this with the, you know, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They had a bunch of different celebrity figures and people they respected on the cover of that album, and it included Aleister Crowley, because they themselves were getting involved in this idea of mysticism and revival of these occult ideas. And so I think what happens is there is this esoteric undercurrent to our culture, regardless of where we are in the world. And there's a lot to draw from underneath that. And when people do dip the bucket into that well and they pull something up that's recognizable and it matches things out of history, well, then it can draw them to be more interested in it and sometimes revive it. And you see that especially in times of hardships when you're maybe not so happy with the way your government or organizations are. So you see that with the mid-1800s, of course, with Lévy, who is protesting the church. And you have that in the 1960s when people were protesting all sorts of things about establishments and civil rights and everything. So and then you see it again now. There's been a resurgence of it. So yeah, I think there's a wellspring of ideas there, and people dip into that well and pull it out. And I think it's a shared idea. I think that's why part of the way to fight that esoteric is to understand it and bring it to light, let it be an exoteric thing, and to help people understand that when you see a symbol like Baphomet, that it can only hold power over you if you allow it to.
Right.
And when other people tell you what it means and what it was made for, then that's power that you've lost.
It's really funny. And to add to that, it's really funny how people want to take those little degrees of separation in religious philosophy and say, well, that's bad because, but don't realize that the degrees of separation between Catholicism, Gnosticism, Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, are very slim. I mean, there's just a little bit of degrees of separation between the two. And if you figure, if you want to take Jesus and put him right in the middle between all of those, there's very little that separate. I mean, you know, the man practiced almost all of them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to sit and say, well, that's not good because, you know, he was, you know, Jesus was a rabbi. Okay. So as a rabbi, I mean, he had his own Gnostic stuff he practiced. He had his own Kabbalah he practiced. He had his own, you know, he practiced the Jewish faith. So what's good? What's not good? What are we throwing out with the bathwater here? What are we saying is good? What isn't good? You know, who are we to say what's good and what isn't good? And what are we saying is necessarily, you know, who are we to judge? And then we take the, you know, as a Catholic, you know, we take and we look at Baphomet and say, no bad, because it turns out that one or two organizations has taken and either trademarked it or they said, well, nope, that's our symbol. You know, we're laying claim to it now. But it doesn't mean what it necessarily means.
And that's a really good point, too, about the trademark and all of that, because you have the Church of Satan, who has been really busy trying to erect statues of Baphomet that are also altered because the original Baphomet image didn't have children in it. And so there's a statue that's gone up with Baphomet with little children looking up to him. And it gets put out next to, usually in government buildings. The argument is, hey, if you have a nativity scene at Christmas, we're allowed to put up Baphomet. So they fight for religious rights. So if you look at the Church of Satan and what they're trying to do, they're really just trying to fight for this idea of free speech and religious rights. And so you could look at it like that's reasonable and logical. Mm-hmm. And then you can also look at it like, well, clearly they're trolling.
Yes.
Because it is that, because it will. So if you're a Christian and you are very much put off by this idea, the very last thing you want to do is get scared and fight it and freak out. And because then that's basically playing into that, that other side. Because if we didn't freak out about it, they would just go on to something else. That wouldn't be an interesting way to poke the bear. But it does force us to confront those issues of freedom of speech and, separation of church and state. So it's being utilized as a counterforce and an adversary and as a point of reason and wisdom. And, you know, but that's not necessarily meaning that the Church of Satan itself and those people that are involved in that organization are somehow these great Enlightenment figures that are just fighting for everybody's rights and all of that. Because, right. I mean, you can guarantee that it's an organization of people like anything else. There are good people, there are bad people, and people who know what's going on and people who don't know what's going on in different levels of it. So, but again, if you see Baphomet going up in your in like the town square, you certainly could protest that, but at least understand what you're protesting. And that's my argument, is to say, look, don't be afraid. Don't have that sense of fear, because true faith and whatever faith that you have, you're not supposed to walk in fear. You're supposed to be protected by that faith and know that some silly statue or image isn't enough to rattle that. Now, if it's being used and to lure children somehow or something like that, I mean, that's a different question. And these are just the modern battles that we find ourselves in. But it's not necessarily what Baphomet, the Templar's Baphomet, was. And that's where it's important to understand that what it's become and what it was are just two different things now. Right. It may have some sort of flavor or essence of the rebellion of before, or some sort of messaging about the unity of opposites, but it's not the same image. So it's incorrect to imagine the Templars worshiping this goat statue and all of this. It's just incorrect historically.
Yes.
So, you know, an important thing to think about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With that, let's remind people, Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon, is available right now. We have a link to it in the description of this program. And folks, I'll tell you, read it from cover to cover, and it's a very interesting book. It's got not only just not only does it have Templar history in it, it's got some history of Baphomet and how it relates to the Rosicrucians, how it relates to how Levy related it to the Freemasons, and how Levy himself related to the Freemasons, and how he didn't necessarily relate to the Freemasons. How he rejected them magically, which is in a whole interesting chapter in itself, which I'll leave you to go look at the book to read that. That's a very interesting chapter. How one magician looks at the Freemasons and goes, "No, that's okay, not my flavor," which I found incredibly interesting. I mean, you've outdone yourself here, Heather, as far as this book. It's one of those things where if you're a true fan of the paranormal, supernatural, of history in itself, that if you're going to want to sit down with this book and take a good look at it, just kind of with an open mind, read everything and figure out where this symbol has gone from beginning to right now, and why people take iconography, why they take symbols and co-opt it for themselves and take it to where they take it. I mean, it's very interesting what we do with symbols and why we want to take them for ourselves and do what we will with it. So you've done an excellent job, Heather, and I tip my hat to you.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for your kind words. I do hope that people give it a chance and understand that it's okay to learn about things that are maybe negative. It's through the education and that we start to not fear things. You know, fear is based in the unknown. And so whatever your faith is, it's good to know exactly the history of something so that we understand that we battle not with flesh and blood, but with the principalities. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Dr. Heather Lynn, I thank you so much for being on the program. Again, if you want to learn more about Heather, we have a link in the description of this program as well. Heather is going to be on Ancient Aliens this next year, right, Heather?
Yeah. Yay.
Yay. So there
another season.
Another season. So you can check out Heather on Ancient Aliens as well. We're looking forward to seeing her on television as well. Dr. Heather Lynn, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. As always, it's so great to talk to you, and you're so well-versed in Templar history and so great person to talk to about this subject matter. Thank you again.
Well, thank you. I want to thank Dr. Heather Lynn for being on the big program today. Name of the book is Baphomet Revealed, Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. It's available right now. We have a link in the description of this program. Again, I encourage you to go out, get the book, take a look at it. It's got some really good history in it, if anything. I know you may have some trepidation about it, mainly because of its iconography, its idolatry. You may say, well, it's just plain evil. Well, put that aside for a second and look at it just for what it is, a symbol, and the history of this symbol. And look at the great work that Dr. Lynn's put together. And read about the history of this symbol, this icon, from the time it was put together to right now. And look at the way it's been kind of twisted from its very beginning to now. The way it's been used and the way that it's been interpreted. I think you'll find it very interesting. And even the history of the groups involved with that symbol. It's very interesting. It's kind of funny, folks, when we open our eyes and we kind of look around and see how the other side lives, so to speak, and just get to know other areas of the world, get to know other people, and do it without a judgmental eye or ear. How interesting the world becomes. When we can do that, and this isn't me getting on my soapbox or anything, but when we do that, it makes our understanding of things so much easier, and we become much more tolerant of different people's perspectives. And I found in my old age, at least, that I enjoy getting to know other people's perspectives. I'm not as quick to judge. I'm not as quick to get into arguments. I'm not as quick to temper. It's one of those things where I want to understand more where people are coming from, because everybody's got an interesting point of view. Everyone really does have interesting experiences, and not everybody comes from the same point of view or same angle. So why not hear them out? Why not hear where someone's coming from? Because everyone has something to add to this little gumbo that we call life. So I highly encourage you to check it out. It's called Baphomet Revealed: Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. If anything, for a nice history lesson. There you go. There's nothing wrong with getting a history lesson, right? So there you go. All right, coming up on the weekend, folks. This weekend, as you're listening to this podcast now, the trip is about to kick off up at the Palmer House. I'm going to include the link in the description of this program for Ghost Stories, Inc. I'm not quite sure if there's, again, because I'm not running the trip, I'm not sure if there's still a ticket left for this weekend. You can check into it, but we're going to have a heck of a time up there. It's going to be a good time at the Palmer House Hotel. Myself and Jessica Freeberg and the Ghost Stories, Inc. crew. Hey, come on up and join us if there's still a spot available. If not, they have another trip coming up in January. I suggest you get on it right now and get a ticket. Because we're gonna blow the doors off the place. We're going to have a good time. So I suggest you look at that and get a ticket for that. If you're not joining us, that's okay. That's okay. Have a good weekend anyways. Be a light in someone's darkness. Go out there and help someone out this weekend, or just hang out and be good company for somebody this weekend. It's supposed to be a little chilly this weekend, so it might be an indoor weekend this weekend, where maybe you just bring over a meal for somebody or make somebody a cup of coffee or a nice warm cup of tea and have some good conversation with someone. That sounds like a nice way to spend the weekend. It certainly does. Just a side note, my chippers are starting to go into torpor. I mentioned it this week. What's kind of interesting is if you go to the original Darkness Radio page, I do have a video of Spud, little Spuddy, who's talking to me about the Blue Jay who keeps stealing her peanuts. What's really cool is Spuddy now has over 3,600 views on that little video, which I think is just the coolest thing ever. I didn't get a chance to tell Spud before she went into torpor that she's becoming a video star, which I thought is the coolest thing ever. I wish I could have, but she did a little cool thing for me, and I haven't posted it on social media yet. I kind of got caught up in the events of the weekend, last weekend, before I got into my week, but I wanted to tell you guys about it before we ended the week, and I mentioned it a little bit, you know, this week, but just the fact that she took in, before she went into torpor, she does this thing, and she did it last year, she did it this year, where she gave me this little tribute of seeds to make sure that I would be okay, and she put it on my chair. I don't know where that comes from. I wish I did, because the other chipmunks don't do that. They don't give back like that and drop a little thank you gift, so to speak, off on my chair. But Spud does. And I'd like to think it's because I have this bond with Spud. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, you have to think of it this way, that's a wild animal. Spud's not my pet. You know, I didn't go purchase Spud at the local pet store. I didn't pick her up at the rescue, you know, and train her. You know, she doesn't have a leash. I don't have a cage for her inside my house. Spud runs free. And although I gave her a name and I put out a dish for her of food, she really is a companion, you know, just a wild animal that I talk to, which most people would think is absolutely batshit crazy. Right? I mean, let's face it. It's kind of crazy to have, you know, a guy sitting on his porch talking to chipmunks. It's very crazy. But just on a, a whim and a leap and a hope that these little animals understand you, and spending time with them and to build a bond is really quite cool. It's really quite the stress reliever, right? So to get that, and I have a little something special, a little bond with each one of these little guys, but that I thought is so cool. What I did, I mean, the thing I haven't really disclosed, I think, on the air here is that last year when Spud gave me this little bounty of seeds, I put them back into a dish so that the chippers could have it for next year, right? So and of course I didn't tell her that. I didn't want to break her heart. I wanted her to think I ate them for some weird reason. I know that sounds weird, right? This year, I actually took and put them in a bottle and held on to them just so I'd have them. So I'll hold on to this year's bounty that she gave me. Just because I want it for myself, just for a reminder. Because chipmunks have such a short lifespan. I mean, they really do. I think the average lifespan out in the wild is something like 2 to 3 years. And if a human actually helps take care of them or cares for them, their average lifespan is 4 to 6. Yeah, and that's a long time. Like 6 years is very long. So it might be closer to like three to five if a human's taking care of them. I don't expect Spud to live 5 years because she's put out a few litters of pups. So, and she had 2 litters of pups this year. She had a mid-season baby with Chili. So I'm a little worried about her. I don't know that she's going to make it to spring because she kind of slowed down a little bit towards the end of the season. But I'm hoping she makes it. I really do, because I'd like to have her back next year. So I'm hoping that, I won't say if, I'll say when she comes back in the spring. I'm going to be optimistic that when she comes back in the spring, I can maybe take out some of those seeds. I won't take out all of them because I want that reminder. But I'll take out some of those seeds and I'll share them with her. And we'll have our own little reunion. And then we'll have more happy times in the spring. But I think what I'll do, I know I threatened to put up a blog earlier this summer of the chippers, and I may do that. Indy is still awake. He's still awake in the garage. It's freezing out there. Normally, it's in November, the chippers go into torpor because it gets so cold that they finally go into to go to sleep. I think Indy or Chili or one of them, it's one of the two, is still awake. I want to say it's either Indy or Chili, but whoever it is, they really love almonds and they're going to put me in the poorhouse for eating all these almonds. But they're, one of them is still awake. I think it might be Chili, because Chili, and I think you're going to think this is crazy too. Again, this is the rantings of a madman who talks to chipmunks. So bear with me, and I'm almost done with this. But Chili is the mid-season baby that Spud had. And Chili is kind of running behind. Chili is a little bit of fumble feet and is kind of clumsy because, again, mid-season baby was getting his coordination together. Probably didn't gather all the seeds that he should have before winter. So he's probably staying up a little bit later. So what I've been doing is I've been putting out seeds in the garage because it's too cold to be outside to be gathering food. So Chili has a little entrance to his den that extends into the garage. I know most homeowners would lose their shit, pardon my language, if they had a chipmunk in their house, but it doesn't bother me. So I put a couple of dishes out there, and I put dishes with food, and I fill it a couple of times a day. He doesn't bother anything else in the garage. So that he can catch up, so that he has food, so he can store up for the winter and be ready. Because I don't want to lose one. That's just me. And I know you may say, oh, Tim, you're a bleeding heart. Well, I just don't like to lose one, especially one of Spud's. So there you go. You can leave comments in on any of the services and tell me what a dumbass I am or whatever, but that's just the way I am. So hopefully we get everybody back beginning of the spring and we'll be able to continue this saga again. And I'll put up a blog with pictures of the kids, the chipmunk kids, and you can get to see pictures of all of them. So you'll get an idea of these guys. So I don't know where I was going with this, but I was just wrapping up the whole chipmunk thing for the year so you don't have to hear it again until spring. But they're my little lights. So there you go. Okay, with that. Lots of good movies coming out. Red One is coming out this weekend, so I may go check that out. I may have and I'm going to try to get my nephew out to it. And I'm going to have my nephew Gavin on the show here soon to do a movie review. I don't know what we're going to do the movie review about. We're going to try to go out and see Venom, but they didn't do a screening for it. So, he's going to be on the show here sometime soon. So you actually get to hear someone other than me talking about a chipmunk on the show. All right. With that, we're going to wrap it up. We'll also, Jess and I will talk about the Palmer trip next week. We get a big week next week. And we've also got an interesting week as far as guests go. So we've got a big week planned for you next week. Thanksgiving week is another huge week. So guys, we've got some big weeks coming up into December, and we're going to keep rolling into the holiday season here. So again, if you have a guest that you want to hear here on this program, please don't hesitate to send me an email, tim@darknessradio.com. We want to get on these people that you want to hear as well. One more reminder, please support the show. Go to our store at darknessradioshow.com. There's a shop there. Get something for your money. If you want to donate to us, I don't have a way for you to donate to us directly. I don't have that button up on the website yet. I'll find a way to do that. But get something for your money if you wanted to quote-unquote donate. You could do that by buying something at our store. I've had a few people ask how they can donate to the show. I don't have a way to do that, but you can do it by buying something. Just buying something in our shop. I am working on t-shirts and hoodies and stuff like that for the holiday season. Hopefully I'll have that done here in the next week or two. So there you go. That's it. I'm done rambling. Have a great weekend. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your families. Take care of your friends. Be a light in someone's darkness. We'll see you right back here on Tuesday for True Crime Tuesday for Beer City Bruiser. Oh, by the way, continue to keep Beer City Bruiser and his family in your prayers. Again, he lost his brother, and the family's going through a tough time. So continue to keep those prayers, those thoughts, that good energy going for that family as they go through that loss of his brother, Mike. So for Beer City Bruiser, for Jessica Freeberg, for Mally Fox, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to the best in true crime and paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.